This episode is brought to you by DistroKid. Did you know that using DistroKid's Teams function, you can route any percentage of your track earning to a band member or collaborator? This is a free feature for all DistroKid members. Take advantage of this awesome function and so many more using our DistroKid discount link, distrokid.com/VIP/MPW.
What am I saying?
This is MPW,
the podcast
with your host, Zylo Aria.
Cool.
A podcast about music production
for the everyday musician,
where we learn from experienced studio engineers and each other.
Helen Noir is a London-based soprano who combines performance work with composing, orchestration, sound design, and production. She works in film, theatre, fashion, concert hall, and performance art. Her recent film work has included co-scoring a horror feature film and creating music and sound for short films such as Microcosm and Isn't It a Beautiful World. Hello, Helen, and thank you for being on the MPW podcast. It's lovely to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me. It's really great to be on the podcast.
It's a pleasure. And I am keen to get into talking about lovely orchestral sounds and how we can get them from home. But before we do that, I'd love to hear a little bit more about your career. Mm-hmm. So how did things start for you in music and how did you get to where you are today?
So it's quite a circuitous route. I was always more interested in music than almost anything else, but I actually studied medicine at university in Tasmania and ran away after 3 years and came to London and never really went back and spent the next kind of 10 years or so trying to figure out like what I wanted to do and how to get into music and, you know, not really understanding what my path was or, yeah, what my route in was. And I ended up doing quite a bit of performance. I'm a classically trained singer, although I haven't studied at a university, but I've had a lot of training. And I was doing quite a bit of performance with a group called Theo Adams Company, who are a cult performance art group here in London. And we were in situations where we didn't have a lot of money for productions. And so they'd need someone to master a track or do something with a track production-wise. And I kind of took it upon myself to teach myself how to do those things and kind of fell in love with production that way and taught myself from the ground up. So I didn't have any training in production at all. And then I got into doing live soundtracks for films once I kind of started writing music myself. We would play films at various venues with the subtitles on and the original sound down, and I would make, you know, new soundscapes for them, also completely new original music. So they became more like art pieces than cinema pieces, and they ended up being reasonably well known. I ended up doing one for the BFI, the British Film Institute, and through that I got into doing music for film in general. And so 4 years ago I started studying an MA in orchestration for film and television, because I wanted to be as versatile as possible in film composition. And a lot of work in film now requires, especially in the lower end of the budget, which is where I work most of the time, people need to be able to do everything. So electronic production, you know, vocal production, orchestras, working with real orchestras, working with fake orchestras, working with, you know, orchestral musicians and a mixture of the two. And I really wanted to be as versatile as possible. And I got very into virtual orchestration that way.
Okay. Oh, lovely. Yes, it does sound like quite a moving career, yeah, in different directions. And it's so common in the music industry, though, that people find their path in such different ways. And starting in medicine, I don't think we've ever had that before.
It was a very long time ago now.
Interesting. Yeah. But how did your family take that, out of curiosity?
Well, my family,
like, I'm done with this.
No, my family really wanted me to study medicine, and my father in particular, who's no longer with us. So, he was not particularly excited about the prospect of me leaving and running away to go clubbing in London. But, yeah, that's what happened.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
you know, I still have an interest in medicine, and I still think it's very important, I think, when you're researching projects, that you research beyond just film and music. And, you know, having an interest in science certainly helps. So I don't regret having done it, but I'm also glad that I didn't follow through with it completely.
That's good. Yeah. So can you tell me an event in your life that you feel like you have learned the most from?
I don't think there's a single event. I think it would be really lovely to go, oh, that was the day that I had my revelation. I was like, I'm going to be a film composer and everything's going to be amazing from here on in. It was a series of small revelations and a series of meeting the right people and figuring out quite slowly what it was that I wanted to do, rather than one event that really kind of changed everything and made me think, oh, this is it. But I do always come back to the feeling that music gave me when I was very, very little. You know, it's always been the thing that I've connected with the most emotionally. And I remember as a very small child listening to Renaissance choral music and thinking, oh, this is the music I'm going to die to. You know, I was a very dramatic child, but it's, you know, I had this connection with music. This will be playing for my death. You know, that I had this connection with music that I didn't really have with anything else, even though I loved reading and, you know, there were other things that I was interested in. But music had this ineffable, you know, power over me. And I think I've been finding my way back to it ever since. So it was probably things that happened in childhood that never really went away.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
Yeah. And I'm sure it can be hard to pinpoint one event, but we like to put guests on the spot.
I know. I would love to say, oh, it was the day that I met this person, or it was the day this happened. But I think it's been a very gradual unfurling for me. Yeah.
Oh, which is a great thing as well, to have discovered the journey, you know, one step at a time. So that's great.
Yeah, absolutely.
So could you then tell me a random fact about yourself that maybe not that many people in the industry know?
I tend to work in avant-garde theatre and kind of, you know, art house films, and my interests are modern classical music. So people are always really surprised that I'm super into early U2, because it just feels like like a weird pivot. But I think the production on their early albums, whether it's the Steve Lillywhite stuff or the Daniel Lanois and Brian Eno records, everything up to and including Joshua Tree, I really like. So I think, yeah, maybe there's some music that people don't expect me to like. And it's really,
okay.
Yeah, it kind of stops the room when I mention that at parties.
Okay, right. Well, it's always good to have a varied music taste.
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, you know, I think the production on Back in Black, AC/DC's Back in Black, although it's not my genre, I think it's like impeccable production. So I think there's lessons to be learned from lots of different genres. People are always surprised when you say that kind of thing to them.
Yeah, for sure. So getting into our topic today,
yes,
Helen, which is all about creating quality orchestral sounds from home.
Yes.
So when we're talking about orchestral sounds for the purposes of this episode, we're talking more about virtual instruments rather than live instrumentation. So why would you say that these sample libraries that we can use, or if we're using synth sounds, why do they not sound very realistic when you're using them out of the box?
Straight out the box. I think this is something that frustrates a lot of people that I work with. I tend to work quite a lot with electronic musicians who want to start work, you know, like pop musicians, for example, who want to start putting really lush, beautiful string arrangements into their work and want them to sound like Larry Gold. And, you know, they'll get a string library, a decent string library, and they've heard the demos and they get quite frustrated that just playing it out of the box, it sort of sounds like strings, but it doesn't sound realistic. And I think it's very much the same as with electronic instruments. You know, if you're working with a beautiful hardware synth, you have to learn how to play it. You know, it's capable of doing all the things that you want it to do, but you need to know how to program and how to manipulate. And sample libraries, the modern sample libraries, have so many parameters that are editable and that can be, you know, played around with in MIDI, and you really can do a lot with them, but you kind of have to know which parameters you need to work with in order to get a realistic sound. And this is the thing, if you're talking about realistic sound, that's a very specific kind of way of working. If you want a non-realistic sound, and sometimes people do, that's completely okay as well, you know, but if you're trying to mimic the sound of real instruments, so you want to kind of trick people into thinking that you've got a real orchestra, you need to be continuously thinking about how those instruments are played in the real world, how a musician would approach playing different kinds of notes, different kinds of articulations, different kinds of styles of music, and then how to apply that knowledge to the parameters that you can edit with a sample library.
Okay. So when you're talking about knowing
the instruments and how they are played mm-hmm. in the real world. Yeah. Would you say you need to have a thorough knowledge of how to play all those instruments to be able to do this well?
I think if you get really into virtual orchestration, yes, you do need to know a lot about all of the different orchestral instruments. And I'm learning all the time. You know, orchestrators like myself tend to be generalists. We don't necessarily know how every instrument is played spectacularly well, but we know enough about all of them that we know what questions to ask musicians and we know what things to do to make things sound good. I don't think there's any one principle in orchestration that's complicated or difficult. It's just lots and lots and lots of little bits of knowledge. For example, if you're working at the string library, if you just press a note in a string library and say it's a string pad violin, a violin section, for example, and it's a sample of, you know, 14 violinists playing the same note, and you just press a note on your keyboard and then you stop pressing that note, you know, it's going to have a very abrupt start and stop. And that's not how a string player would play a long note. They would ease into that note and then they ease off again at the end. And so knowing that, you need to think, okay, well, how am I going to manipulate this sound and what parameters am I going to use in order to make this sound like a realistically played long note on with a violin section? Violinists aren't going to go stop and start playing the way that you can with a synth. So that's the first kind of bit of knowledge you would need to know about a violin player, that when they play long notes, they ease in and ease off. It's not kind of stop start unless they're trying to get a very particular sound. But in general, there's kind of lush sounds that people want in pop arrangements. There's a crescendo in and a diminuendo out. And so you need to start manipulating your sample libraries in order to get those. The really good thing to know, though, is that there are so many parameters that you can affect with sample libraries, and people who get really into it will, you know, be talking about the minutiae for days and days. You can get 90% of the way to a really good fake string recording if you just know about volume, expression, and vibrato. So those three parameters are the ones to start working with and start manipulating and start, yeah, when you're recording in a MIDI line.
Okay.
So if I'm writing a string line and I want a long, lush note and I want my string section to sound like they're really kind of giving it something, you know, it's very emotional kind of performance. So they're going to go into it and it's going to be a crescendo up to the top of the note and then back out again. There's many, many different ways of doing it. You can assign those parameters that will come with your sample library to controllers. Or, like I do a lot of the time, you can record them in badly and then redraw them again later on. I do lots and lots and lots of drawing of automation lanes with the work I do with sample libraries, both to get the result that I want and also when I'm stacking sounds to make sure that they're not all exactly the same. So the crescendo in for the first violins, for example, is not exactly the same as the crescendo in for the second violins or for the violas. They're all slightly different. They're doing the same thing, but you're humanizing what you're doing. So lots of people like to start with faders, working with faders. So you would be playing a note on your keyboard while you're using assigned MIDI parameters of expression and dynamic to maybe a fader, maybe a third one for vibrato. And other people like to just play notes in and then just manipulate everything afterwards with just drawn lines. There are many, many ways of getting to it. There's breath controllers and all kinds of things you can do with MIDI orchestration. But generally, the best results and the quickest results are either using faders, which you would assign with MIDI Learn, or, yeah, just drawing in, getting your automation lanes up and drawing in curves.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So those three things that you mentioned about the expression, dynamic, and vibrato, would you often see them as parameters just as they're called there, or would they be called something else?
So expression tends to be the intensity with which a note is being played. And this is something that's very important to know about orchestral instruments. So if we talk about a trumpet, for example, well, let's first talk about synths. If you're playing a synth and you have a synth that's just a bit loud, you just pull it down in the mix so it's a bit quieter, but it's the same sound. Orchestral instruments have a different tone at different dynamics. And so you need to manipulate that into your sound when you're working with the instruments. So the sound of a loud trumpet, the sound of a loud violin is different from the sound of a quiet violin or a quiet trumpet. It's not just the same sound turned down. And so all of the good sample libraries will have that as a parameter. And when you are using your fader or drawing in your automation to go through, it depends which sample library you're using. Some of them call it dynamics and some of them call it expression, but it's the same thing, basically. When you are manipulating that from sort of low to high values, you're moving through different sample layers. So you're moving through samples of instruments played quietly through to at the top of your line where you're super intense through to samples of instruments being played loudly. And the better your sample library, the more lush and the more, you know, smooth that the transition between those two things is. So you are using your dynamics to affect the overall sound, but you're also affecting the expression. So it's not just about an increase in volume, it's about an increase or a change in tone from quiet to loud. And that's a very, very important part of making orchestral samples realistic. For example, I've seen people do or give me work where, you know, they have, for example, a trumpet played very, very loudly, and they've just turned it down in the mix to match the volume of the other instruments. But then it just sounds like a loud trumpet that's been turned down. It doesn't sound like a quiet trumpet. You need to start again and you need to like bring down your expression faders or draw in your automation line, bring down your expression somehow so that you're playing with samples of quietly played trumpets rather than just loudly played trumpets turned down. So this again goes back to thinking about how the instrument works in the real world all the time and knowing that, you know, a trumpet player isn't going to play a quiet note with the same tone that they're going to play a loud note. And that's true of most orchestral instruments. You know, there's a difference in tone. Sometimes different parts of the range have a completely different tone as well. So none of these particular concepts are difficult, but it's just kind of building up a body of knowledge so that you can put all these things together and end up with a recording that sounds somewhere close to a group of real musicians rather than just a bunch of samples played straight into a keyboard.
Okay. And did you build that knowledge yourself as you went, Helen? Like, was it watching how these instruments were played, for example, to then copy
when
that?
I started my MA in orchestration, I got into the university based on my production skills. I had done no orchestration ever in my life. And I'd been around orchestral music most of my life. I've always loved classical music. I sing classically, but I don't play any orchestral instruments. I've been around people who play them, but I hadn't had to think about like what was going on. So I had to just basically start from the very beginning. And we started with strings and we thought about, you know, we would write things for strings and think about all of these things. So this is a really great way of getting into working with virtual instruments. Don't try and do the entire orchestra in one weekend. You know, start with a section, start with an instrument that you're interested in working with. And for most people, that is strings. And yeah, learn all of these little things about how strings work. Listen to recordings of strings being played. If you can, speak to instrumentalists who play strings. And all orchestrators at any level, you know, there are people who are much, much better than me at orchestration who will still say they will ask real musicians questions about how their instrument works all the time, you know, because it gets very detailed. And the more you get into it, the more you want to know, like, okay, what fingering would this person use for this particular kind of passage? Is this kind of idiomatic? Is this something that fits well under the fingers of a violinist? Or is it something that is a little bit more difficult for them to play? You're thinking about all of these kind of things all the time. The problem often with working with sample libraries is that you have a MIDI keyboard and it's all laid out for you, and you play very pianistically, or you play as you would a synth, you know. And so every note in the range of your sample library can be played equally well, equally loudly, equally quietly for equal amounts of time, you know. But that's not how those instruments work in the real world. In the real world, you're thinking about what's the best part of the range for certain instruments. You know, for brass and wind instruments, they need to breathe, for example. Are you putting little gaps for breath in your wind instruments? You know, this is something that is an instant kind of red flag if you are trying to make wind and brass parts sound realistic. If you've got brass parts that just go on and on and on, and there's no kind of little gap where a real player would be playing, that instantly marks your work as, oh, this is a MIDI recording and it's not a real recording. So these kind of things, you know, you're always thinking, how would this work in the real world? You know, what would my real instrumentalists be doing? And how can I mimic that with the sample libraries that I have?
Okay, yeah. So you were talking before about layering different samples and how that would work. So can you tell me a little bit more about that, and how do you make that sound convincing and not just like...
Yeah, like you've layered a load of samples. Layers. Yeah.
Yeah.
You need to be very judicious with your layering. Strings, for example, layer really, really well. And this is one of the reasons why in the orchestra, in the standard Western orchestra, you can have different numbers of string players, but you'll always generally have, you know, four French horns and two trumpets, for example. Those numbers don't vary, but strings can be 10 strings or 16 strings, depending on how many players you can afford or what the orchestra is. And that's because strings just blend super, super well. They blend with each other across the entire range, from violin to double bass, which is obviously the lower end of the string range. And string libraries often blend really, really well. So I will often stack string libraries on top of each other because different sample libraries will have a different tone. And I will choose one as my main sound. For example, I work quite a lot with BBC Symphony Orchestra from Spitfire, but I also really like the tone of Cinematic Studio Series, which is a small Australian company who make amazing samples. They have a sort of richer, darker tone. So if I choose BBC as my main tone, I can then layer in, if I want a slightly darker tone on top of that, layer in some, certain amount, maybe 20% by volume of my other string library. And so I get a slightly different sound. And you also add to the realism in other ways, because we talked about, you know, adding in automation for expression, dynamics, vibrato. You can make those automation drawn lines slightly different for each library. So that would mimic a bit more the sound of what a real string section are doing, because not everybody in a string section is going to be playing exactly the same volume and exactly the same time, even though they're following the same music. So that's one of the ways that you can start introducing some realism in. You have to be careful, because sample libraries are recorded in different rooms, so they have a different natural reverb often. And I have heard recordings where it's very obvious that it's just like a whole hodgepodge of things. But if you're careful with it, you can make it sound really, really beautiful. I know somebody who did the music for The Traitors in the UK. Not that, so it's different music from the Australian one, but it was like a smash hit here. It was so amazing. We all watched that recently. And so they had a lot of like epic-y kind of music. It was all sample libraries. They didn't have any real orchestration. And he layered BBC Symphony Orchestra and, I believe, Cinematic Studio Series as well. So just getting those two together with slight variations between the two kind of helped with the realism of what he was trying to create. There's also a thing with articulation, which is the techniques that people use to get particular effects. So with string libraries, for example, that would be arco, which is bowed strings, pizzicato, which is where the string is plucked. There's marcato, which can be a bowed note but has a very sharp attack, so it's kind of digging into the string. You have all of these different kind of articulations, and most sample libraries will have versions of all of these. And one of the things I think is really important to note is sometimes I have people come to me and they're like, oh, well, I've got a section where everybody needs to play marcato, for example. Everyone needs to be really digging in on the beginning of the note. It needs to sound super dramatic and super aggressive. And I've used the marcato patch and it's just not sounding right. And in that situation, I often stack articulations that aren't called marcato, but that if they're stacked can make that marcato sound more exciting. So maybe it might be a short staccato patch, or it might be a tiny little bit of tremolo at the beginning of the note. And then I'll use volume automation to just like fade it all off really quickly. So it just sounds like everybody in the orchestra is really giving it everything right at the beginning of that note. So stacking articulations, particularly with strings, is really important. With instruments that play mainly by themselves, you have to be a bit more careful. I will sometimes blend, you know, an oboe sound for a solo oboe line, for example. But with solo instruments, it can often sound very quickly like two different samples. So you need to be really careful about that. They don't stack in the way that strings do. But sometimes it works really, really well. You know, you want a slightly richer tone for something and you're just not getting it from the sample library that you're working with, so you would get it from somewhere else. You do need to be careful with patches in sample libraries, I think. So quite often in a good sample library, you would get a solo French horn patch, for example. Then you would have the sound of a patch of two French horns playing together, and then probably four French horns playing together, because they have a very different sound in the room than you just using four different samples, you know, because they've all been recorded in the same space. But if you start playing chords with the patch that's four horns, for example, you've suddenly got the sound of 16 horns playing, because it's 4 times 4 times 4 times 4, you know, if you're playing a 4-note chord. And that can be the sound that you want if you're making very epic music and you're not intending your music to be recorded by a real orchestra. That might be exactly what you want. And if it is, then amazing. But if you're going to then give that music to a director to sign off on, and then they're going to give it to an orchestra or a group of real players, they might be disappointed because they've suddenly got the sound of 4 horns playing what you've kind of convinced them would sound like 16 horns. So this is another area where stacking things, you just need to be thinking again about how these instruments are working in the real world. You know, what am I actually doing? So if I'm stacking articulations that aren't caught, you know, for a particular effect, and that sounds okay, that's great. But if I'm stacking articulations and I'm getting a different sound than I would in the real world, then I need to maybe rethink what I'm doing.
Okay. Mm. Okay. All right. So a few things to think about there to make sure it's playable.
Yeah.
The way it's intended.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. No, it's good to consider. And when you were talking about getting a sound that you're going for and perhaps wanting to layer that with real musicians,
yes,
what kind of things do you need to think about to get that sounding convincing?
I mean, that can be a really fantastic way. If I ever can, when I'm working on film projects and we don't have budget for an orchestra, which happens very often, if I can, I will get at least 1 or 2 real players in to play the same lines, for example, as my string line, and just blend that in. So you're just hearing a little bit. You're not hearing separate, you know, your sample library and your real player as 2 separate things, but you're getting the realism of that real player blended in with your sample library. And it can be a really great way of kind of tricking the ear and people not really knowing whether you've actually used a real orchestra or not. You know, it really ups your game in terms of, if you can ever afford to do that, it's such a great thing to do. Obviously, if you are going to do that, then you need to think about your notation and making sure that you have written the music exactly as it needs to be played so that your MIDI version, your virtual orchestration, matches the notation that you've given your real player. But if you can do that, it can be a really fantastic way for relatively little money, adding, you know, a huge amount of realism to something that you're doing. When you work on big studio sessions with big orchestras, you're generally talking about union rates, which is completely fine. I'm all for the unions. But, you know, it's a very expensive prospect. If you have somebody double a line in the UK, for example, that's extra money. If you have someone play 2 instruments, that's extra money. You know, so if you're working with orchestras, the financials stack up really, really fast and you end up, you know, paying quite a lot, which is as it should be. But if you're working with maybe 1 or 2 musicians and their friends or somebody that you know, you can have a bit of a different relationship, and that can be really nice because you can work in maybe a small studio. You can ask someone to play the same line several times, and as long as you're paying them adequately and everybody's happy with what they're getting, you can ask them to do things that you wouldn't be able to do in a union session. And so it can be a very cost-effective way of making your music sound suddenly, you know, 50% better than it did when it was just samples. We spend so much of our life in virtual orchestration trying to get our orchestras to sound amazing and as they would in the real world. But equally, we know the real thing always sounds better. So if you can add in some of the real thing, then, you know, always do. I did a film recently where it was all kind of Charlie Chaplin pastiche. They wanted lots of string waltzes, and it was really, really fun. But there was a piece towards the end of the film where they wanted some Spanish guitar, or the director wanted some Spanish guitar. And that's one of the instruments that's really hard to do with samples. It takes a lot of manipulation and a lot of programming to make it sound, you know, really spectacular. So I just got someone to play it. And it was, you know, an hour of their time. It was relatively low cost for me. And the whole thing sounded so much better than if I'd spent a day trying to program it. So sometimes with virtual orchestration, it's also good just to, you know your limits and be like, okay, this is the budget I've got, but I'm going to spend this much just in this piece. We're just going to have somebody play it for real because it's going to be so much easier and so much lovelier.
Oh, for sure, for sure. No, I think it's a good thing to think about is sometimes it's not just about saving money, but it can save you a lot of time just get someone in and do the job.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I love working with
real musicians anyway. It's just always really fun. So that's great.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course. Yeah. So if we just talk about, like, at a high level, I'm guessing that you're starting with MIDI and then you're turning it into notation to then
Yeah, that's what I tend to do.
Yeah. So could you tell me overall, how does that process work? Mm. So you've made something in Ableton and then where do you go from there?
So I do all of my orchestral programming in Cubase because the MIDI programming capabilities is a lot of subtlety that you can add. You can use, you know, I'm door agnostic, use whatever door is the best for you. But I tend to do my electronic work in Ableton, my orchestral work in Cubase because there's all this amazing MIDI stuff. And then I mix in Pro Tools, which is what everyone uses in orchestral sessions. So I kind of need to know what that is, know what's going on with Pro Tools. But yeah, you can use any door at all. A lot of orchestrators will write straight into a notation software and then get someone else to do their mock-ups, which is what we call, you know, the demo versions. Because I'm usually doing everything, I do the demo versions first and then notate. And I think if you're starting to work with musicians, and it can be such an exciting thing to do, you know, people get very intimidated by working with real musicians. But there are a few things that you need to know kind of starting out, because I think there's a psychology of working with real musicians where if you walk into a studio session, it's just you and a couple of people and your charts or your parts are kind of wrong. They don't have the right information. They don't look like the kind of music that people would expect to see. It just kind of, you know, there's room for a lot of questions. And I think people just tend not to relax in the way that they would if you gave them like a beautiful looking piece of notation. They're like, oh, okay, we've got this. This is going to be a great session. You know, this person knows exactly what they're doing. So there are a few things to think about. You need to know what kind of level of detail a musician's going to want to see on the page. And that means knowing what volume, what dynamic to give them. And that has to match the dynamic that's in your MIDI mockup. It's no good giving, you know, a violinist a piece of music and asking them to play it quietly when your mock-up is all people playing full tilt. You know, so matching those dynamics, I know it sounds really basic, but, you know, it's very important. Range is really important as well. As we mentioned before, you know, when you're playing a MIDI keyboard, you can play any note in an instrument's range from your sample library, and you can play, you know, you can play a trumpet's top C for half an hour if you want. You can't do that with a real musician because although they have that note in their range, they can't play it continuously for a long period of time. You know, it's not comfortable for them. So you have to be thinking about where the music sits within a musician's capabilities, you know, what a thing that we call tessitura, which is not just about the absolute range of the instrument, but whether it where it sits in terms of where most of the notes are. You know, you can have some high notes, you can have some low notes, you can have some drama, but you've got to make it comfortable for the musician. And you have to think about how they're physically going to play that. French horn players, for example, really amazing instrument. I mean, so difficult to play. I'm in total awe of French horn players. But they need to breathe quite a bit, like all brass people do. And, you know, their lips get tired. Again, that's the thing. You know, so if you're giving them lots and lots of very difficult work, and you're not giving them a few bars rest every now and again, you're going to find that they're not going to be able to play things in one go, or they're going to get very tired and the music that you're getting at the end of the session isn't as good as at the beginning. I think musicians won't mind if you've written music that's difficult for a reason. You know, it's virtuosic because you understand and you know that you want this drama and you're really like, you know, going to go for it in the session. But if you give them music that's difficult for no good reason, you know, you're given the music that's in a difficult range, and it would have been easier if, you know, for example, if it's very low trumpet music, it might be easier for a trombonist to play that, you know, because it's going to be notes that are very comfortable for a trombonist, but are very hard for a trumpet player to sustain for a long period of time. Those kind of things, if you haven't thought about them, yeah, you're just not going to get the best out of your musicians. And again, this is just lots and lots of little bits of detail and talking to real musicians, looking at scores if you know how to read music, you know, seeing how great composers have written parts for their instruments, what part of the range they've written for, if they've written very fast music, how long that's for, you know, how much room they've given their players to rest and recover. And then another really important thing, which people tend to forget, is that in the orchestra, and this sounds like a nightmare, but actually it's not. You just need to get your head around it a little bit. A lot of orchestral instruments are what we call transposing instruments, which means that the note on the page is different from the note that sounds when they play. And that's like due to like really long, boring historical reasons. But because it's been done that way for hundreds of years, it's not going to change anytime soon. So you often see, if you have a conductor score, for example, and then a part for, say, a clarinet, the notes on the page for the conductor score and the clarinet are different. And if you extract your notation from, say, Logic or, you know, another DAW without thinking about the fact that you've got a transposing instrument playing and you give that music to the instrumentalist, they will play notes that you don't expect them to play because they're reading notes that are the wrong pitch for them. There are some great pieces of software that can help you with this. Dorico SE is completely free. Sibelius First is completely free. I would definitely recommend Dorico over Sibelius. It's a very powerful program and it will do all of this for you. So you can put your notes in your conductor score, and then when you look at your parts, they'll all be perfect for your instrumentalist. They will adjust the notes to match whatever they need to be for your transposing instruments. But it's one of these things that's kind of like, it really throws people if they go into a recording session and suddenly, you know, their clarinetist or their trumpet player is playing notes that they don't expect. It's like, what is going on? So it's something that you just need to be aware of. And as I said, it's not particularly difficult, but it's just like remembering that these things are part of working with orchestral musicians. And if you can get them right, you'll just have a much more relaxed session. As I said, you know, if you give a piece of music to an instrumentalist and it looks right, it's got enough information about the expression, the dynamic, the notes are right, you know, you've given them the right articulation, you've put staccatos if you want short notes, you've written it all out properly, you're just going to get a much better result from your musicians. They'll relax into what they're doing much more easily, I think.
So it sounds from this like you need quite a good and in-depth understanding of music theory to be able to do this process. Would you agree or?
No, I think it sounds like a lot, but I've worked with people who don't read music and are still able to get this stuff to work. If you do read music, then that's super, super helpful. Not everybody does. Most people, I mean, it's not as easy for some people as it is for others. Most people can kind of learn enough that they can get themselves set up for a simple session. But I would just say it's just being aware that there are things you need to watch out for rather than, oh my God, I need to learn everything. You know, like for example, when I first started orchestrating, I didn't learn necessarily what the transpositions are for all the instruments, like how different. I just knew like, okay, I'm going to watch out for these instruments because I know these have different sounding pitches than they do from, you know, so it's just that kind of thing. It's not being overwhelmed by it and just trying to think of it from the musician's point of view. So even if you don't read music very well or you don't understand notation very well, just thinking, okay, as a musician, what am I going to need? I'm going to need the notes to be right. I'm going to need directions about how loud or soft to play everything. I'm maybe going to need a couple of, you know, bits of information about, you know, play this with passion, play this somberly, you know, those kinds of things. And I'm going to need my articulation. So if I want my string players to pluck notes with their finger, I'm going to need to write pizzicato, for example. If I want them to play with the bow, I'm going to have to make sure that those notations are correct. So it's just being aware that there are a certain number of things you'll need to watch out for. And I know it can seem like a lot all at once, but you get to grips with it pretty quickly, I think.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's good to know. Good to know that, you know, we can start somewhere and go from there.
Yeah. Yeah. I would say don't be intimidated by it if it's something that you haven't done before. You can definitely do it. I think anyone can learn orchestration. You know, just don't try and learn it all at once. That's the thing. Just be aware that there are areas you'll need to concentrate on, but just add in little bits and little bits and little bits and suddenly you know lots.
Okay. One step at a time.
Yeah, exactly. One step at a time.
So can you tell me, Helen, and you did touch on this already, but what are some good libraries to start with, would you say? And what's maybe something that's maybe low cost for someone to start with as well?
So, I mean, all of the DAWs come with orchestral instruments. They're not necessarily the best quality ones, but in terms of just starting to play around with these articulations and looking at expression, dynamics and vibrato, you can definitely start doing that with the stock instruments that come with your DAW and then move on to something when you feel that you need to. Spitfire do a free version of BBC Symphony Orchestra called BBC Discover. And it has a limited number of articulations. It doesn't have everything that you'd need to do a fully professional job, but I've heard people make really nice music with it. It's quite wet. It's very reverby, but as a first instrument, it's you know, more than adequate. And it has expression and dynamic and vibrato that you can assign quite easily from the GUI to your faders or your automation lanes. So you can start playing around with drawing these things in and trying to make things sound more realistic. So that's a really good start. Spitfire also have a series of instruments called Labs, which are completely free. And they are generally treated instruments. So, you know, kind of frozen strings or guitars with effects or trumpets with effects. But they kind of give you a sense of what's possible with orchestral sounds. And some of them are quite filmic. I know people who've used them on quite big film projects. So that's a really good place to start as well. You can download as many as you want for free. And then once you start really getting into it and you want, you know, a decent quality library, you know, I know people who own £60,000 worth of sample libraries and their work doesn't sound £60,000 better than people who own 3 or 4 sample libraries and know how to use them really, really well. I tend to work with BBC Symphony Orchestra and Cinematic Studio Strings, Cinematic Studio Brass. Those are complete orchestra, so it's a bit more expensive, but they have sales several times a year and you'll have everything. Cinematic Studio, I think, is a great place to start. And they also have sales and student discounts. And I think you can get their strings, which is what I started with for, or at the time, I think it was sort of £200 or £300, which I know is a lot. It's not, you know, a tiny outlay, but you will hear people talking about how you have to have, you know, thousands and thousands of pounds worth of sample libraries to make really good virtual orchestration. And it's just not true. It's working with the libraries that you know and learning them really, really well, knowing their sound, knowing what you can use them for, knowing their application. Occasionally, I will not be able to do something with a sample library that a director wants me to do, and I'll have to think of a way around it because the libraries that I have just don't have that particular sound, or they want something a bit more avant-garde. But, you know, for most of the work that I do, those two libraries work really, really well.
No, that's a really good thing to mention as well. And it's something that we talk about a lot in MPW mm-hmm. in our teaching as well, which is around plugins for different effects and yeah. things that tools that you're going to be using in your production. And it's much better, even if you're just using stock plugins, to be really familiar with them rather
yes,
than having
absolutely,
you know, 20 different compressors and you don't know what the differences
you don't,
are.
You
and
just
when
don't
to
need
use what.
Them. No, I would always, you know, recommend starting with something small and then moving on when you find that you've kind of outgrown that, or you need something for a project that it just, you know, like the Charlie Chaplin film I was doing, we needed a French accordion and I didn't have that in a sample library, so I had to go out and get one that I thought was good. I wouldn't have bought that initially. You know, I didn't need that 6 years ago when I started. It's something that you just grow into.
Yeah. No, that's great advice there. Yeah. Really good. Awesome. Well, I have learned a lot about this topic, Helen, in a short time.
I know it's a big topic, but, you know, my main takeaway is I just don't want people, I know I feel like I've thrown a lot of people all together, but I would just say, you know, don't be intimidated by it. Anybody can learn this stuff, and it really can elevate your work if you want to start adding, you know, string arrangements or brass parts to the music that you're using. But yeah, always be thinking about how does this instrument work in the real world? How am I interpreting that with the sample libraries that I've got?
So we are now at the speed quiz.
Oh my God,
Helen. So are you ready?
Yeah, go on.
So it's 5 quick fire this or that question, and just think of the first thing that pops in your head. So, oceans or mountains?
Mountains.
Roller coasters or water slides?
Roller coasters.
Headphones or speakers?
Speakers.
Festival or rave?
Rave.
Oh, Mac or PC?
Mac.
Okay. Mm. Oh, that was one of the speediest quizzes we've had.
I know what I like.
Good stuff. That's good. Important skill to have. Mm. So coming to our top tips then, Helen, can you tell me what's your one top career tip?
Don't try and do everything all at once and don't be overwhelmed by how much there is to learn. I taught myself production, and when I first started, I couldn't do anything. I remember the first thing I learned how to do was to sidechain in Ableton, and this was years and years and years ago. It took me like 3 days, and then I couldn't remember how to do it afterwards, you know, but I was just like, oh God, this is awful. I'm never going to know how to do this. You know, my computer hates me. It's definitely, is it not for me? But I think this is it, you know, this chipping away at things, like just putting in 10 minutes here, 20 minutes there, watching a tutorial on YouTube, talking to someone who knows what they're doing, just not letting yourself be overwhelmed by how much information there is and how much there is to learn. And then you look back and, you know, suddenly 3 years have gone by and you're like, oh, I know how to do all these things, you know, and some of them are so automatic now. You know, I have, well, it's probably the same for you. You know, when I have friends come around and I do, you know, some mixing for them and all the EQ moves are really quick and you know which compressor you want and you're, and they're like, how? I'm like, that was, it didn't happen all at once. You know, don't be impatient with yourself. And it's the same with orchestration. You know, I know, as I said already, I've thrown a lot of information at people and there is a lot of information to know to get good at this, but it's all achievable. You know, it doesn't depend on having some innate talent that only a few of us have. It's the kind of thing that anyone can do if they're willing to put some time in. So you just chip away, you do a little bit here, a little bit there, and suddenly, as I said, you look back and you know it all. Well, not all of it, yeah. But you know, you never know all of it, but you know what I mean. You know enough to, yes, to be working in, oh, the field. Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Important point there. And it's such a good thing to mention to look back and think about how far you've come, because I think we, absolutely, always feel like there's so much more to go, yeah, but forget to look at everything that has happened so far.
Definitely.
So, yeah, no, good thing there. So what's your one top self-care tip?
I'm bipolar, so mental health is really important to me. It's very important that I look after myself that way because I can get very unwell. I would say sleep. I tend to avoid projects where I know I'm going to be asked to do day after day after day after day after day of like very demanding hours. I don't mind doing some days here or there where you know, you have a lot on and you don't really get home until late and then you're leaving again early in the morning. But if I have more than 2 or 3 days of that, it's an entire month's project that's like that, then I can't do it. It just makes me very ill. So I've become very good at figuring out which projects I should be working on. It doesn't mean that I don't work really hard. I love what I do. And, you know, when I did a theatre project last week, for example, and the 3 days in the run-up to the show were super frantic, but I know that that's short term and I know that I can, you know, cope with that. Yeah, I think that's my top sleep. Sleep. Yeah. No, and making sure that I work with people who will let me sleep.
Yeah, No, it's good. It's good. And it's important to have those boundaries. And mm-hmm. I think especially when you are a musician and particularly you're starting out and you feel like you need to say yes to absolutely everything, it's maybe good in some ways, but then sacrificing the longevity with which you can do it for. So
absolutely. And it's not, you know, it's not always possible. I know it's a privilege to be able to pick and choose projects. You know, sometimes you have to take things on that you know aren't going to be very comfortable because you need to get to the next point. But I think, yeah, at some level, you always need to be thinking about who are the collaborators that I'm choosing? You know, who am I working with long term? And finding those people who are going to have the same attitude to work-life balance that you have, you know, so everybody wants to work really hard on a project, but everyone takes care of everybody as well. It's really important.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's good. And what's your one top general life tip?
Just love it. You know, I think there's very much an attitude, and it kind of relates to my previous point. There's very much an attitude in our industry, in film and in production, that you're not really working unless you're working super hard and you're like, oh my God, I was at the studio for 23 hours yesterday and I'm exhausted and I've got another project this week. And, you know, it's just like, I'm like, are you enjoying it? No. It's like, enjoy, you know, you've got it. It's okay to enjoy it. You know, we're making art. That doesn't mean that we have to suffer because we're being privileged enough to make art. It's allowable to love it and to have a great time while you're doing it. And not every day will be like that. Absolutely. But overall, if you can, you should be working on projects that bring you joy, where the people involved are making you happy and the work is brilliant. And yeah, it doesn't all have to be suffering and misery. No, and I think there's a lot of competition in this world to be like, oh, well, my life's harder than yours. Or, you know, I had to travel more this month, or, you know, my client's more difficult. So I just want to love it.
Yeah. Oh, that's a great point. I love that. Yeah. And we are doing something that's meant to be fun, uh-huh, which is making music.
Yeah.
So why are we turning it into this massive chore and a competition of how bad it is.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, I love that. Thank you so much for,
thank you for
your time,
me.
Helen. It's been such a pleasure, and I am sure a lot of people will find a lot of different takeaways there to be able to take their first steps in orchestration.
Well, my website is helennoir.com. My email is there. You know, I know I probably glossed over some things quite quickly, but if anyone's got any burning questions and they want to email me and say, you didn't explain this very well, or could you go into more detail, then I'm more than happy for people to contact me if they'd like to.
Love that. We'll put that in the show notes as well. So that's great. So thanks so much, Helen, and I hope you have a good night.
Thank you so much. Have a good day.
Bye. My biggest three takeaways from Helen's episode was, firstly, to think about how your notation for your orchestral instruments would work in the real world with real instruments. This will allow your notations to sound more realistic, and especially before you send them to a musician to play. My second biggest takeaway was to think about the three areas of expression, dynamic, and vibrato, and having some automation within your virtual instruments of these three areas to make your sounds more realistic. My last takeaway was to make sure that you use a lot of automation, especially between layers of string and orchestral sounds, so that it sounds like different people are playing them. That's it from us this week. I hope you enjoyed the episode and look forward to seeing you in 2 weeks.